Blog Talk Radio.
Reserving the right to object, and I will object, to the unanimous consent request by Senator Scott and offer my own resolution. Unlike Senator Scott's resolution, mine is short and to the point, and I think it expresses the feelings of the overwhelming majority of people in our country and, in fact, throughout the world. And this is what our resolution says, quote, whereas every Palestinian life matters, and whereas every Israeli life matters, now therefore be it resolved that the Senate urges an immediate ceasefire to prevent any further loss of life and further escalation of conflict in Israel and the Palestinian territories, and supports diplomatic efforts to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to uphold international law, and to protect the human rights of Israelis and Palestinians. And I'd like to thank my colleagues, Senator Warren, Senator Van Hollen, Senator Kaine, Senator Carper, Senator Heinrich, Senator Murphy, Senator Merkley, Senator Ossoff, Senator Leahy, and Senator Markey for co-sponsoring this resolution. I would also like to point out that those of us who are supporting an immediate ceasefire are certainly not alone. We join with nearly the unanimous call from the European Union, with United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, with Pope Francis, and with many others. In other words, all over the world, people are seeing the terrible tragedy that is taking place in the region, and they want an end to it as quickly as possible through a ceasefire. Now, I happen to have read Senator Scott's resolution, and I was particularly struck by one sentence in it on page 2. And what it says, and I quote, the Senate mourns the loss of innocent life caused by Hamas's rocket attacks, end of quote. That's on page 2. Now, I certainly agree with that. And I think every member of Congress agrees with that. The loss of 12 innocent Israeli lives is, in fact, a tragedy. But what about the loss of 227 Palestinian lives, including 64 children and 38 women? Does Senator Scott not believe that the loss of those Palestinian lives, 64 children and 38 women among others, is not a tragedy? I believe that we should be mourning the loss of Israeli life, but we should also be mourning the loss of Palestinian lives. Or perhaps some people think that Palestinian lives don't matter. I would hope not. And let us be very clear that when we talk about the tragedy that is now taking place in Gaza, what we are talking about is not only the terrible loss of life. As I hope most people know, Gaza, before this war, was an extremely poor and desperate community, and the latest Israeli bombardment has only made a bad situation much, much worse. Let us remember, Gaza has been under a blockade since 2007, imposed by Israel and Egypt. Most people are unable to leave. Basic necessities are extremely hard to obtain. Gaza is the home to about 2 million inhabitants. Its population density is among the highest in the world, just a huge amount of people squeezed into a very small area. More than half of the population of Gaza, some 56%, live below the poverty line. 70% of the population is receiving aid, according to estimates by the United Nations. Food rations constitute most of that aid. Unemployment in Gaza is around 45%. 48% of the population is under the age of 18, and 70%, let me repeat, 70% of the young people in Gaza are unemployed with no hope for the future. And because of this war, the bombardment from Israeli planes, the situation has gotten even worse. Today's New York Times reports that the Israeli bombardment has, and I quote, this is from the New York Times, damaged 17 hospitals and clinics in Gaza. Got that? 17 hospitals and clinics have been damaged. The bombardment has wrecked its only coronavirus test laboratory, sent fetid wastewater into the streets, and broke water pipes serving at least 800,000 people. Sewage systems inside Gaza have been destroyed. A desalination plant that helped provide fresh water to a quarter of a million people in the territory is offline. Dozens of schools have been damaged or closed, forcing some 600,000 students to miss classes. Some 72,000 Gazans have been forced to flee their homes, end quote. That's from the New York Times this morning. Perhaps the situation has gotten even worse. I don't know. And I want everybody to think for a moment what it means to be living in a very small territory with dozens and dozens of planes attacking and bombing. What does it mean in particular to the children of Gaza? Jess Ghanem, a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, who specializes in the psychological effects of armed conflict on children, told USA Today, and I quote, quote, "What children in Gaza are exposed to on a regular basis exceeds anything that any children anywhere else in the world experience. There's basically no place to go for these children. They are unable to escape," end of quote. When you put people on the
That was Senator Bernie Sanders, I believe last Thursday, talking about, it was before the ceasefire, talking about the condition of the people in Gaza. And today we have a special edition of Radio Free Kansas. We have a special guest who's been there. Yeah, listeners. And who knows Middle East history. We have Jennifer Lowenstein. Let me see if I get her on the air. Jennifer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hello? Jennifer, thanks for coming on. This was Sanders before the so-called ceasefire, and I noticed the next morning after the ceasefire, all the mainstream media, probably including the New York Times, was saying, you know, it's holding, and I guess they call it quote holding even today. However, there was an assembly of Palestinian youth at the, Al-Aqsa Mosque or something.
Yes.
The Israeli police were still firing tear gas and rubber bullets into crowds of assembled youth. So, I mean, it's like, yeah, they declare a ceasefire. They're not shooting each other with missiles. But instead, if people get together in any kind of crowd, they're still tear gassed and shot with rubber bullets and all kinds of stuff, and
right.
Arrested. It's I mean, I saw it. It was, I think it was on a live footage. I think Reuters provided it. It was a live footage, mm-hmm. and I thought, well, they're not lobbing rockets and blowing, back and forth, but there's still this ruthlessness of the Israeli police on assemblies.
Yes.
So I thought, it's
worse than that.
Go ahead.
It's even worse than that.
Go ahead.
Well, just yesterday, actually today for their time, a number of Israeli police blocked off what's called the Temple Mount or the Haram Sharif, which means noble sanctuary, and so that Jewish settlers and Jews could worship up there. That's an incredibly provocative act because it's right at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam. This is where we've seen these scenes of violence for the last almost month, really. And then to go and block this area off, keep Muslims out of the area so that in many cases religious fanatics, Jewish settlers, can go and pray up there is very, very provocative. And yes, just before that, when worshipers were there, Israeli police were once again going into the mosque and the Dome of the Rock, using tear gas and stun grenades. This is, maybe we want to say the ceasefire is holding. It is in the sense that there isn't bombing of Gaza going on at the moment. But it's all very, very provocative, and it makes me wonder what is it that the Israelis are trying to do. I mean, when you provoke people like this, it's fairly natural to get a response. Obviously,
right.
I don't think that Hamas wants to start firing rockets from Gaza again, because we've seen what the destruction is like.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, there was a report that you emailed me, and then I confirmed on Democracy Now. Is it possible that they were actually targeting doctors when they left the hospital? If they didn't target the hospital itself, maybe they did. I think they did, according to Senator Sanders. They were targeting health clinics,
yes,
but they were killing doctors and their families. When the doctors would go home to take a break and go home, the Israelis would send a missile into this house and kill the doctor and his families.
Saying
the names of some of these people. Go ahead, tell us.
This is nothing
that.
New.
Crazy.
It's really very. It's sadistic, and it's also incredibly brutal. And, the fact of the matter is, in the 11-day war, which is what it was called, I don't know that I would call it a war so much as a slaughter, 14 families were completely wiped out. 14 families are no longer on the civil record. They no longer exist. And this is deliberate. Israel has the intelligence so that it knows people's homes, people's names, the number of people in their families, exactly where they live, what they do. I mean, I've been to the Gaza Strip many, many times, and there's almost always a surveillance blimp floating overhead, gathering this intelligence. You can't go into the Gaza Strip and not be surveilled. So when doctors and children and women and older people die in these airstrikes, much of it is completely deliberate. It is deliberate. There's no question that the Israelis know who they're targeting, when they're targeting them, and why. So the real question is what's going on in the thinking of the minds that are carrying out these bombing raids? What is their ultimate goal? And there are lots
right.
of answers to that, which I could get into, but it's not pretty. It's not a pretty scene.
So, these aren't just random targets. And you're saying it's a surveillance state itself within Gaza, and they know
That's
who
right.
they're killing
Gaza,
deliberately.
Gaza is controlled by land, by sea, by air, and certainly through cyberspace. by Israel. There are people who will say, no, no, Gaza's not no longer occupied by the Israelis. The Israelis left Gaza in 2005 in the disengagement. Well, yes, the Israeli forces and the settlements that were in Gaza in 2005 pulled out. The settlements were disbanded. People were had to leave, basically. And the Israeli military installations within Gaza were dismantled. But that is essentially like allowing the prisoners in a prison to then rule themselves, because Gaza is still a 17-mile-long prison with 2 million inhabitants who can't leave, and whose lives are blockaded. And the Gaza Strip has been blockaded, people say, since 2007. The truth is Gaza has been intermittently blockaded for a lot longer than since 2007. So what goes into the Gaza Strip is also controlled by the Israelis. What people eat in the Gaza Strip is controlled by the Israelis, because the exports from Israel into Gaza are determined ahead of time. This is a prison that is completely controlled by Israel on the outside. And the fact that there was no ground invasion this last time around is very interesting, because it speaks to the fact that the Israeli military knew that if it had invaded by ground, they would have suffered enormous losses, and they didn't want to do that. So there's a lot going on here that I think people are not aware of. And this last conflict, I think, is a harbinger of a lot of things to come, which could be very dangerous, not just for the Middle East, but for the world.
Yeah, I think I expressed a lot of frustration with John Grant, listeners, if you listened to Tuesday. Last Tuesday, John Grant and I talked about it, and John did the best he could trying to help you and I, listeners, understand that. I think Jennifer can do a better job. John's never been there, but he knows, he has a good sense of it. And he was saying Tuesday that he was alarmed because there were reports that there were reports. Now, they were very short reports, listeners. It was happening at literally as he was talking, but he gets the New York Times, unlike anybody in Kansas. And he said that there were reports that there were massing troops at some border, you know, and it was, and he was alarmed because he said that would, it would just go crazy, you know, batshit crazy.
Yeah. Right.
If they invaded again with the military,
it would have been a complete success. Absolutely.
Well, John, and I can only expect, I mean, John has, yeah. But how did this thing really, I mean, okay, we can't go all the way back, maybe you can, but do it in a way. We've got about 40 minutes here. Triggered this immediately. You know, a lot of Americans I know, especially Christian Americans, or Kansans, don't have an understanding about the mix of the population within Israel. It just sort of reminded me. I was like, there are such a thing as Israeli Arabs. There are Arabic
right.
people, and I guess there were some demonstrations similar to what I saw on Reuters live feed yesterday or the day before. You know, tell us. I mean, something. What's going on with the Arab Israelis? I mean, how many are there approximately? Do you know? And go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, a lot of people today don't like the term Israeli Arabs, because the Arabs living in Israel are Palestinians. They're Palestinian Israelis. And if anything, the last 11 days, this 11-day slaughter, what it showed more than anything else is that the 2 million Palestinian Israelis living in what is called Israel proper do in fact feel a great deal of solidarity with the 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip and the 4 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and the 300,000 Palestinian Israelis living in Jerusalem. And what we have to understand is that 2 million Palestinian Israelis have Israeli citizenship and live in Israel, the state of Israel. The West Bank is occupied. It's Palestinian land, but it's occupied by Israel. The Gaza Strip is Palestinian land, but it's occupied by Israel. When Donald Trump came to power, the thing that he did, he lit a match and threw it into a barrel of gasoline. And he did that by recognizing Jerusalem as the, quote, eternal and undivided capital of Israel. Jerusalem was illegally annexed by Israel after the 1967 war. Jerusalem does not belong to Israel under international law. It is an illegally annexed territory. But Donald Trump basically came along and said, nope, I'm going to recognize Jerusalem as the eternal undivided capital of Israel. And he did that knowing full well that the Palestinians consider East Jerusalem the only viable capital of a future Palestinian state. Now, this has had huge ramifications, and one of the consequences of Donald Trump's actions was what we just saw. You had worshipers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque being harassed, beat up, shot, killed in some cases. And, you know, you have Palestinians in Gaza and Palestinians in the West Bank and Palestinians in the rest of East Jerusalem and Palestinians in Israel saying, no, Jerusalem is sacred to us. We're not just going to stand back and watch this anymore. This is unacceptable. Jerusalem is the third holiest place in Islam. That is what started the Hamas organization from firing its rockets into Israel. It was saying, leave Al-Aqsa alone. And it galvanized solidarity among Palestinians in all of these areas. Trump thought that by cantonizing, by fragmenting Palestinian communities, and he wasn't the only president who did this. The president, you know, Obama before him, Bush before him, this cantonization process, this fragmentation of Palestinian homes, and, you know, the West Bank has been divided up so that there are Jewish settlements as well as Palestinian villages. The intent is to fragment Palestinian territory so completely that you destroy the Palestinian national movement. Well, what a failure that whole process was, more than Trump's recognition of Israel as, I'm sorry, of Jerusalem as the eternal capital of Israel, and moving the U.S. embassy to it and saying it's eternal, it's undivided, it belongs to Israel, and screw the Palestinians. Too bad if they want it as their capital. It's not going to happen.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm still trying to figure out myself. It does, but it's sort of like it's from the other side. It's from a side that I don't think anyone really out here in Kansas gets. And if they do, they... I think many Kansans are just horrified at the ferocity of the shock and awe. I mean, for me, and I know I've talked to some of my neighbors, this was like they thought in their mind what they saw was similar to what would happen to Baghdad and Iraq just a few, you know, it wasn't that long ago.
Horrible.
And
yes,
they were horrified because they thought, my goodness, does anyone realize the kind of destruction that this is causing? And it's like the whole Middle East is going to be a pile of rubble if these people, and they keep trying to say if these people keep fighting, but I don't think they have any, very few of them listen to Senator Sanders' speech. Fortunately, I found it on YouTube, and I happy to do it. But I mean, honestly, I don't think a lot of people have landlocked Kansas. I mean, they just don't. They don't get it.
That's
and,
right.
They're horrified because I got to tell you, there are Trump supporters who voted for Trump because he promised to end the endless war, you know, and that affected. I've got people out here who are, you know, their support for Trump, you know, was pinned on this thing about the ending of the endless war. And I don't, I think everyone's shocked because it's like,
Trump poured fuel on the fire. He didn't come close to ending it. He poured fuel on the fire. When you give a capital like Jerusalem to one country and say, okay, Israel, it's yours. It's your capital. We're going to move the American embassy there. Whether it's East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem, it's all one united city, and it's yours, Israel. And there's another people saying, wait a minute, this is our capital. It's the capital for a Palestinian state. You're going to make a lot of people, in this case, between 6 and 7 million Palestinians, very, very unhappy. You can't take a city like that that is so sacred to three major Western religions and say, Israel, it's yours.
Right.
Not without making another whole people furious, especially because Islam, you know, Muslims in general, if I had to make a statement, and maybe some people would disagree with me on this, I would say that of the three Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, of those three Western religions, I would say Muslims are more devout in general than Jews and Christians. Jews and Christians have become very, very secularized, and there is a great deal of secularization in the Muslim world as well. But I would say in terms of real devoutness and belief in God and belief in holy places, I would say that is strongest among Islam. There are lots of reasons for this that I won't go into today. A lot of it is just because Islam is a much younger religion in many ways. But the fact is, if you go and give the third holiest place in Islam to Israel and say it's yours, it's your capital and the Palestinians can't have it, you make a lot of people, not just Palestinians, angry. I mean, Muslims worldwide are saying, wait a minute, East Jerusalem does not belong to Israel. Under international law, it does not belong to Israel. But Trump came along and said, yes, it does. But in fact, we're going to move our embassy there. We're going to have it there. We're going to recognize it, once again, to repeat myself, as Israel's eternal and undivided capital. And screw the Palestinians and screw their desire for a single state. They're not getting it. You're going to have deep dissatisfaction among an entire people when that happens. Trump did that. And that is part of the reason why this exploded so badly, so violently the last 2 weeks, because you've got people, Muslim worshipers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, worshiping in this holy place, and you've got Israeli Jewish soldiers going into the mosque. Imagine that.
Right.
Imagine soldiers coming into your church while worshipers are praying during the holiest holiday of the year and harassing worshipers. Imagine how the Western world would react, the Christian world would react, if they saw Muslim soldiers going into a sacred church and harassing and tear gassing and beating up Christian worshipers. They would go ballistic. So
well, they
why
almost
should
did.
Anyone be
I'll
surprised?
Tell you, Jennifer, they almost did over the simple fact that they wouldn't have to wear a mask.
Right.
I mean, here in Kansas. I mean, these people, and
exactly.
It took no police. It took no tear gas. They just went crazy over the fact that public health people were trying to get the churches to go by the COVID-19 guidances. I mean, and they went crazy. They were crazy on the floor of the legislature, listeners.
Right.
Yeah.
This was a public health crisis. Add religion and religious fervor into the mix, and you can't you increase the tension exponentially. And this is what's happening in Jerusalem. At the same time, Israeli soldiers are beating up and tear gassing and throwing stun grenades at worshippers during Ramadan in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they are trying to evict families who have lived in East Jerusalem for generations, Palestinian families. They are trying to evict them from their homes in a neighborhood called Sheikh Jarrah and give those homes to Jewish settlers. That's also illegal. That's called ethnic cleansing. That's called transfer of populations. It's called displacement, dispossession, forcing people out of the homes they have lived in for generations and saying, basically, you can't live there anymore. That's not your home. You don't really own it. It belongs to Jewish settlers instead. Going on all the time in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, and in Israel itself. There, most of the land in Israel, the state of Israel, cannot be owned by Arabs. That's called apartheid. That's apartheid. There's one rule, there's one law for Jews, and there's another one for Palestinians. That's going to be really problematic if they're not equal, and believe me, they're not equal. Some people call the Palestinians living in Israel second-class citizens. That's a generous label. They don't even merit that label. They're treated like garbage. Many of their towns and villages within Israel don't even get the most basic municipal services by the Israeli state. So you've got, instead of white supremacy within Israel, you have Jewish supremacy. It's as simple as that. There are two peoples living in the state of Israel, Israeli Jews and Israeli Palestinians, and the Israeli Jews are superior. They get the rights. They get the privileges to live. They get Tel Aviv. They get Haifa. They get Jerusalem. And the Palestinians basically get trash. And they are treated very poorly, both in Israel and the territories, the Palestinian land, that Israel occupies illegally.
Is it possible these settlers could ever be dislocated once they're in these areas? It seems like Israel just keeps expanding. And then I don't even understand it. I mean, I know the United Nations has said that it's out of line.
It's not out of line. It's illegal. Under international law, the settlements that have been established in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, and formerly in Gaza, but they're not there anymore, all of those settlements are illegal. When a nation conquers or another people's land, they cannot, under international law, settle that land. Well, Israel has been settling the West Bank with Jewish settlers since 1967. And we hear all the time, since 1967, settlements have been springing up all over the West Bank, Jewish settlements. They are illegal. They should not be there. But every successive American administration has turned a blind eye to them. They'll say, oh, no, those are illegal. They shouldn't be there. That's not right. But they keep springing up. They keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So that now we have well over 500,000 people living in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. They're there illegally. They shouldn't be there. Everything you can find in international law regarding the settlement of land that you have conquered that belongs to another people will tell you that's illegal. You can't do it. So why do we keep seeing Israel expanding? Why is this continuously happening? And I'm afraid to say that a lot of it is because of the American administration. It's the American government that has Israel as a client state. It's the American government that says out of one side of its mouth, you can't settle that land, that's illegal under international law, And out of the other side of his mouth says, okay, well, we won't say anything. Well, no, those are illegal. You shouldn't do it. Bad boy, bad girl. But then they go and settle the land, and the settlements keep expanding every single day, not every week, not every month, not every year. Every day, those settlements are expanding. Israel is turning into Greater Israel, and the Palestinian land is shrinking by the day. Palestinians wake up in a Palestinian village one day, and the next day they wake up and they find out it's been annexed by Israel. Oh, gee, I don't live on Palestinian land anymore. I live on land that is considered, that has been annexed by Israel. Wait, what's going on here? And as a result, the few rights that I had have vanished.
I have a relative who is retired from Lockheed Martin, and I always try to get him to talk. You know, it's like he's old, you know. But try to get him. What do you guys do? What did you really do? Do you know? Of Dick Cheney's relationship to, you know, this is a few years back. He's very old. And he says, oh, yeah, I've seen them all, you know, like in the hallways, literally. And yeah. I was like, you know, trying to get him. I brought up Israel one time, and he just doesn't talk. I mean, when I pushed him in a corner once over Iraq, you know, that's when he confided in me. Yeah, he had seen these big shot senators and at that time Vice President Cheney. Literally in the hallways where the offices he worked at, and I said, "Well, how do you justify this?" And then I was thinking of him the other day when I heard Joe Biden. Now the figure is a little vague. One report 438, another $738 million in weapons. Joe Biden approved or something sent over there, and then we casually learned that it's $4 billion a year in deals. Some people say
3.8 billion dollars. The United States gives Israel $3.8 billion per year in aid, much of it military aid. In addition to $3.8 billion per year, think about what we could do with that money here at home. In addition to that $3.8 billion per year, Biden recently approved another $735 million in military aid to Israel. Now imagine what Palestinians whose homes are being demolished over them must be thinking when they wake up in the middle of the night to bomb after bomb after bomb. You know, 69 children died in 11 days. Children, little girls, little boys. You see the pictures when they were still alive, smiling faces. Kids who died in this war because the United States is supplying Israel with military aid, the likes of which we can barely imagine, and the weaponry, which is so advanced, it's such state-of-the-art weaponry, that this idea that we kept hearing, Israel has the right to defend itself. What? You know what Hamas rockets are like? They're like glorified pipe bombs. There's no precision guidance in those rockets. And people say, well, they fired 4,000 rockets from the Gaza. Tell you something, that wasn't the act of aggression. Israel is the aggressor. The aggressor does not have the right to self-defense. The people being attacked and assaulted do. So if there was a party that was trying to defend itself, trying to say, stop it, stop harassing and dispossessing and killing us, it was the Palestinians, not the Israelis. The Israelis have state-of-the-art weaponry. They can target somebody inside the living room inside his house if they want to and kill him. Hamas rockets are just flying around out there. They're shot in the direction of Tel Aviv or in the direction of Ashkelon. Hamas has no idea where they're going to land. Now, that is not to say that the death of 12 Israelis is justified. I don't think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it was unfortunate. Nobody should die, especially children. It's wrong. I wish that there could have been diplomacy and real leadership shown in this entire last assault. But Israel doesn't
mm-hmm.
speak the language of diplomacy. Israel speaks the language of aggression. If you do something that we dislike, we're going to stomp on you. We're not going to invite you to
mm-hmm.
the table and talk. We're going to stomp on you, and that's what they do. Look, six high-rise buildings in the Gaza Strip were bombed, were turned into rubble, were turned into dust. All of those high-rises had residential homes in them. And you hear, well, you know, the people in those buildings, they were given, an hour to leave, so they didn't have to die if they stayed in there. Wait a minute. One of those
I've heard I've heard people say that it was less than 30 minutes and in some cases as little as 10. And I noticed that my friends out here were alarmed that they're dropping, because you see it, they show it on TV, they drop these buildings. It's horrible. I mean, they drop them. It's not like they bomb the roof and it blows up the top story or two. No, they're bombing somehow. I don't know how they do this. They drop the whole damn building. It looks like something out of the World Trade Center type crap.
No, the whole building collapses. It literally looks like a house of cards that has been flattened afterwards. And you're right. When I'm talking about a couple of the biggest high-rise buildings, one of them was 14 stories, one of them was 11 stories. In those buildings, there was an hour advance notice given to the residents or workers who were working in offices in those buildings to leave. In many other cases where people's homes were demolished, there was no warning at all. None.
Right.
Closest friends has a sister who lives in the town of Rafah in the Gaza Strip. Her house, these buildings very often are adjacent to each other. One building in Rafah was apparently a Hamas stronghold. Well, that's an excuse given to bomb everything from schools to hospitals to clinics to businesses to sewage plants to, anything you want to say. Oh, it's all in a Hamas, stronghold. That's an excuse, because that's not going to solve the problem. But anyway, a home was labeled, Hamas supporters live there. So it was bombed. Well, my friend's sister and her entire family lived in the home adjacent to that building, and it was entirely destroyed as a result. They were lucky they got out alive, but she and her family have no place to live now. They have no place to live. Their home is a pile of rubble, of gray rubble, and old and clothes and people's belongings smashed into the ground. And I don't think most Americans can begin to imagine what that's like. Imagine a bomb coming through the roof of your home and you knowing that you have, maybe seconds to get the hell out of there. You don't have time to collect your most prized possessions or memories. You just get the hell out. And in seconds, everything you have owned has been smashed into dust. And basically, the family splits up so that two members can go sleep at this sister's house and three members can go live with this brother for a while until they figure out where the hell they're going to live. This didn't happen to one family in the Gaza Strip. This happened to 72,000 people who are now looking for places to live and who have no drinking water and where the electricity is on, if they're lucky, for maybe two, sometimes 3 hours a day, 6 hours if they're really lucky, where the water is not safe to drink, where sewage pipes have water is running through the streets. Imagine the diseases that are born, carried along in that kind of water. So you have no good drinking water, no reliable electricity. You can't use your computers. You can't use your lights when it's hot. And believe me, it is hot as Hades in Gaza this time of year. You don't have your air conditioning. You can't turn on your fan. You know, you're stuck. You're living in rubble. And if you get lucky, UNRWA or another United Nations organization has provided you a tent. And that's where you live. Figure out how to rebuild. But there's a blockade on Gaza. Construction materials are not allowed into the Gaza Strip because they might be used for military purposes. That's the excuse. So the people who have lost their homes and these 14-story high-rise buildings and 11-story, how are you going to rebuild them if construction materials are not allowed into the Gaza Strip? Where are you going to live? Who's going to clear that stuff away? I mean, it's a disaster that we cannot imagine. And this is what Israel did. But we turned on the news, and Biden and Blinken and other Israel supporters were saying Israel has the right to defend itself. Where in Israel did this kind of disaster happen?
Well, there, you know, I tell you, a lot of people sort of, well, I did. I got out on my seat, and other people, I'm sure, you know, in Kansas, probably were upset with the fact that they bombed the Associated Press and Al Jazeera, and I think Reuters, the press offices.
Yes.
But the immediate excuse was that the Hamas was there in the building, in this big building that they blew up. But I was sitting there thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, I don't want to show my age too much.
No, it's insane.
Sure. Hamas should be allowed to have press offices. I mean, there's no question that any organization should have. I mean, hell, even the Weather Underground in the '60s had press releases, and I was sitting here thinking, I thought, you know, if this, you know, who's the outlaw here? I mean, they're. You know, the outlaw, it was no longer a question in my mind that, you know, only a true outlaw country like Israel would bomb the press offices.
Well, let me tell you something.
Go ahead.
I lived in the Gaza Strip on more than one occasion. I spent hours and hours of my time in that building, in the press building. You know, at the time, there was another station called Ramatan. It was a Palestinian press agency that was also in that building. And I had friends there, and I was working as a freelance journalist. So I was in that building all the time. I used to hang around with the BBC folks. The BBC was also in that building, along with Al Jazeera and the Associated Press. Hours. I remember going up and down the elevators. I remember meeting people there and interviewing them. I remember going there with the reporter Robert Fisk from the Middle East. I remember meeting people you wouldn't know the names, like Haider Abdel Shafi, who was an incredible person. You know, somebody who has always demanded peace and toleration and coexistence. I remember meeting him there in that building and having press conferences there and interview. I mean, the idea that that building was bombed because Hamas had an office there, give me a break. You know why that building was bombed? Because it was a press building. And because if you keep that building there, you're going to get even more news out from the Gaza Strip to the rest of the world. And Israel doesn't want us to know what's really happening there. So
I agree, because I thought it was sick that I was sitting there. I was watching, courtesy of the internet, I was watching a live feed. I was listening actually to the BBC, and on my radio at night. I had a little radio, and I put my earbuds on, and I listened to while I'm trying to go to sleep. And I heard this. They bombed. The BBC was reporting that their own office, as well as these other press offices, were bombed. And I got up and Shazam, within 30 minutes, I had the video of them blowing up the building. And I thought, it's a hell of a note that the U.S. news media can't get on this as quick, and the BBC is reporting of their own offices being blown up, you know, as well as the others. I thought that was so supremely ironic. But then We've only got another 9 minutes left. I want to ask you this question. I want to ask what it, you know. You've been there. You've done all this, but this is important to me. How come?
Yes.
Why are people not? How does this outlaw nation Israel get away with not acknowledging that they have nuclear weapons? I mean, what is going on here where there's no international – I mean, I know that even Iran is a signatory to the – Rob, you can answer this question, but Robert Fisk, you said you met him. That's amazing that you met him.
I didn't meet him. I was his research assistant until he died last October.
Yeah, I mean, I played Robert Fisk on Radio Free Kansas listeners years ago when he was – doing work, and man, that's what an honor that you got to know.
I know.
Well, I mean, this is
honestly just to give
amazing,
him a personal note. If that was a tragedy that he died, but yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's just amazing that you had contact with that guy. Because he's in my books as a journalist, he was it was like the man. I mean, he knew
incomparable.
He knew what
I agree. And you know what? We're lucky. I was his research assistant for the last 2 years, up until he died on October 30th last year. And we are lucky about one thing. Just before he died, he completed his last book. Because it wasn't edited and indexed and all of that yet, and it still has to happen. But as a result, probably within the next year and a half, we're going to get another book out by Robert Fisk, and it's going to be fantastic. It's going to be called Night of Power.
Yeah, be sure.
And I sure hope everyone
informed
reads
of that. So what do you think Robert Fisk would say about the outlaw nation, my words, not his, of Israel having nuclear weapons? And I noticed none of the news media has brought that up in this last exchange of hostilities, of conflict. I have not heard one news report about it. Go ahead.
Of course not. There's one major reason why more isn't brought up about this, and it's called the Godfather. Who is Israel's Godfather? Who controls Israel ultimately? And I know that there are people out there who disagree with me on this. If the United States wanted Israel to stop what it's doing, it could stop it overnight. Stop giving it $3.8 billion. Do you know that there's a law in this country called the Leahy Law that says it is illegal to give military aid to any nation that is using it illegally and it's killing civilians? Well, you know what? Did anybody say, wait a minute, Israel is violating the Leahy Law? But Israel didn't just violate the Leahy Law in the last 11 days. It's been violating the Leahy Law for the last 70-some years. Well, I don't think the Leahy Law was around that long. But the fact is, we are the nation that is sitting back and saying, we must support Israel. Israel is our ideological ally. Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I want you to know something. Israel is not a democracy, because a democracy means a government of the people, not of some people, of all people. And Palestinians are not part of the democratic process in Israel, not to the extent that they should be in any real functioning democracy. But the United States turns a blind eye to this. Israel is the back door to U.S. power, and you're absolutely right. Do you know that every nation in the Middle East has favored what is called a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East? Every single nation has said, we will give up nuclear power, we'll give up the pursuit of nuclear power if there is a nuclear weapons-free zone declared in the Middle East. There's one nation that refuses to do that. There's one nation that refuses to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Guess which one? Israel. Everyone with any knowledge of Israeli history knows that Israel has nuclear weapons, probably somewhere between 200 and 300 nuclear warheads. But for some reason, it's not going to come out and say that it has them. Okay, don't say. We'll just look at Dimona in the desert, in the Negev desert, and pretend that it's not there. It's there. They also have chemical and biological weapons, which they manufacture in a small town outside of Tel Aviv. Nobody says anything about that.
Right.
Why?
Right.
Because
really...
the United States doesn't care, because Israel is our client state. Israel will do what we want it to do when we want it to do it. And yes, Israel does have autonomy, and it does often have conflict with the United States. It's not that we have all power over it, but we have enormous power over Israel if we ever wanted to use it. But we don't. Some of that is because of the Israel lobby, which is very powerful.
Well, and Tom Hartman,
the
radio host Tom Hartman, I didn't catch that, but evidently for three straight days, the United States bunged up the United Nations Security Council for 3 days. They wouldn't allow anything to come out, I guess. I mean, I don't understand this. It's like,
tyranny.
How can you...
This is called, in my book, it's called The Tyranny of the Veto. In the United Nations Security Council, anytime one of the five permanent members doesn't like a resolution, it can veto it. And if it vetoes it, the resolution can't stand. So at least three UN resolutions were put forward during these 11 days calling for a ceasefire. The United States blocked every one of those resolutions.
That's crazy.
Imagine that. It's nuts. We blocked three resolutions by three different countries calling for a ceasefire. Why would we do that? Because Israel has the right to defend itself from Hamas pipe bombs that are in response to Israel basically aggressively going after worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and dispossessing people of their own land in Sheikh Jarrah. Israel was not defending itself. Israel was the aggressor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw the demonstrations. They weren't even really demonstrations. They were more like a group prayer. They were peaceful assemblies that they were attacked on the streets. And
absolutely.
We'll have to. I mean, it was, you know, to me, it's like they just basically do whatever they want, whenever they want, and they get away, and they're getting away with it for so long.
The United States.
Yeah.
Do you think
there's been any pressure at all among the so-called progressives in Congress, I mean, Biden?
Yes. Yes, and I'm really glad you asked that question, because if there's any hope, and I think this is very, very important, in the last 45, 55 years, the shift in public opinion to supporting Israel, from supporting Israel to supporting the Palestinians, has been dramatic. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party, including Bernie Sanders, and a number of other senators and congresspeople, Betty McCollum, Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Tim Kaine, not just the so-called squad, many others, but also more importantly within the American public, public opinion has decidedly shifted in favor of the Palestinians, and that is important. I have read that Biden was much harsher in his words to Netanyahu than we know. I don't know if that's true, because I don't know what he said to him, but I would not be surprised if he was somewhat harsher, because he's got to take the pulse of public opinion. Almost every major city in the United States had a pro-Palestinian demonstration during these days, and that is significant. We can't ignore that here. So, yes, there is some hope.
Well, Jennifer, I want you to promise you will come back on again, because this was Kansas needs to hear this. We do. And people, we really need you back on again. Yes, we do. I would cut them off immediately through the UN and say, no, I would send the $4 billion or whatever a year to the United Nations, and then I would also tell them that they got to sign the nuclear treaty too. They're getting away with it. It's outrageous.
They're getting away with
murder. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for coming on and giving us an hour of your time. Let's stay in contact. It's been years since you were on, and I want you back on again. Okay.
Thank you very much for
having
me.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Yep.
Well, listeners, there you go. The network gave me an hour, and I took it, and I hope you enjoyed. That was Jennifer Lowenstein, professor of Middle East history, and she, as you heard, she's been there many, many times. And my God, I did not know she had worked with Robert Fisk, a legend in journalism. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and goodbye.